can be molecular biology, it can be whatever it is. We've got this, how things are, the way it really is. And what he said is, in science, they have this version of the way it really is, which is their basic paradigm or dominant theory of the way. So everybody working in that field does their work within that playpen. And that they're doing what he called normal science. But the trouble with doing normal science is nothing's really normal. If you play with it long enough, some abnormal stuff pops up. And that the way of handling the strange findings, the data that come through in the experiments that don't fit the model, is to disappear them. Because we don't want to know about that. Because what would happen if we knew about it? We would realize there's something wrong with what we're seeing through the kaleidoscope, and we would have to reorganize it, and we're scared of that. And I think the reason we're scared of it, I've thought about this a lot for the last 7 years or so, is why are we so afraid of the new paradigm? What makes us so uncomfortable? And I think what it is, and I got part of this in discussing this problem with Eugene Gendron. We were talking about going into the unknown. Some of you may know Gendron's work. He's the author of Focusing, and he devised the focusing technique, which involves going into kind of unarticulated emotional, into feelings, and letting them tell you what they are. And people feel very uncomfortable when they first start doing focusing, because when they get that inner sense of the problem, it's kind of yuck and funny feeling, and you don't have names for it. And we were talking about it, and I referred to that place of disorganization as the soup. And he said, yeah, and he said, you know, people are really not so much afraid of the new information as they are afraid of the soup. They're afraid of the unknown place. And one of the ways I've come to think about it is that we're afraid when we're between paradigms. We are like between trapezes. We wouldn't mind that new trapeze, but what about that place where we let go of the old one? A man I met recently, a businessman, who said, I met him at the class Warren Bennis was teaching at USC, and this guy told me he'd come from Aspen, and then we talked. And that he lived in both Aspen and L.A. And I thought, well, that's interesting. How do you manage to do that? So I said to him something I rarely say to people, which is, what do you do? He said, appropriately, I'm having a midlife crisis. And I could tell the way he said if it was a full-time job. And he said, you know, it's very weird to be between sets of values. He said, I've let go of the old one, and I don't really know what the new ones are yet. And I was thinking I would redo my apartment, my house, whatever. And he said, and I thought, well, I'll do it in white. I like white. I always did. You know, it was like that place in between. It's like Linus when his blanket is in the dryer. So hold on to our paradigm, and then we need the other one. Well, what Kuhn said is that the scientists will reject all of the anomalous information for as long as they can. They will assume it was a mistake. They will assume somebody else. If they get desperate, like, and this is me talking, not him, in the case of parapsychology, they will simply assume the other experimenters lied, since it doesn't fit the model of reality of what's what. And eventually, though, there's so many of these anomalies have popped up, and the explanations for them, or the ways of excusing them or hiding them, are becoming so tortured that somebody's got to pay attention. And fortunately, there are always a few people who are willing to do that, who are in fact sort of drawn to the conflict and the contradiction. I think sometimes that Einstein said, it's a miracle that any curiosity survives formal education. But some people survive that, which may be why sometimes the paradigm shifts in fact come through people outside the field. because they're not intimidated and they're still curious. But in any event, there will be some people who come up with what happens is they will be looking and struggling with this with the old paradigm and say, how can this be? There's this theory, there's this theory. It doesn't fit. How can it be? How can it be? And they will get suddenly a total shift of perspective, which usually comes about. And this is one way, by the way, to accelerate your own paradigm shift. They notice that there is an assumption in the existing paradigm that maybe doesn't have to be there. That everybody's built into it. And that everybody, when they go to look at the problem, they include this assumption in it. And then go on from there. And maybe the assumption is wrong. See, when you go from one paradigm to another, you don't get rid of the old paradigm. You only get rid of the part of it that was the wrong assumption. Or the limited assumption. The only partially true assumption. So what will happen is they will look at that assumption and then everything will click into place. Before Copernicus, and by the way, there were some people who preceded Copernicus in terms of thinking that the Earth revolved around the Sun, but basically before that time, they had noticed very peculiar behaviors on the part of the planets, if you look at them through the filter of their explanation of the Sun revolving around the Earth and so on. And they had come up with some very elaborate explanations of why the planets were eccentric in that way. Once Copernicus and his peers who were seeing it the other way, once they had that perspective that in fact it's the Earth that revolves around the Sun and the Sun is the center of the solar system, then immediately that was an explanation for why the planets had appeared to be doing what they were doing. So they challenged that one assumption, that central assumption, and then totally radicalized the perspective. And that's a real literal example of a shift of perspective. Now, we assume, because we've lived with knowing that the Earth revolves around the Sun since we were little kids, and we don't really live it. Yeah, I mean, we do say the Sun comes up, the Sun goes down. We don't say Earth rise and Earth set. But we know, somewhere in the back of our minds, we know that, and it doesn't bother us. But imagine if you were living in the time when that idea first emerged. Suddenly, it's thrown you into a different universe. You lost your bearings when they did that. When you've lost your geocentric universe, you lost your bearings. It's important to understand that it always feels very strange because this is a sudden shock. So we can look back and say how dumb of them not to have known that, which is what usually happens somehow from our perspective. Isn't that cute what they thought? But in fact, we have to realize how alarming and sudden the shift was and why people resisted it. Thomas Kuhn pointed out that when the new theory is presented, the people who present the new paradigm are almost always rejected, attacked, ignored, scorned, whatever. They are not loved. Unless they really live to be very old. And, you know, they can outlive. Max Planck said that science proceeds funeral by funeral. Enough people die off, your idea may get accepted. And in fact, what he said is it takes the new generation of scientists without this emotional investment in the old theory to grow up with it, to integrate it, and then at some point, a crucial number of people have accepted it, a paradigm shift is said to have taken place. And then that paradigm is partial, and that paradigm is going to get broken. The only thing is that nobody noticed that, or hardly anybody noticed that. That we do it that way. Certainly scientists didn't notice it. And to this day, for the most part, the tendency is to reject new paradigms. If they're strange enough. And all the important ones are strange. John Stuart Mill, in his essay on liberty, written in the 19th century, had also observed this. He said it somewhat differently. He said, why do we punish or persecute the heretics when they're the only people who bring us progress? He said, some people say that that's okay, because if it's true, it will prevail. If it's true, people are going to someday come to understand it. And he said, yes, but many valuable truths have had to emerge time and again in history before they could grab hold, before they got into a hospitable time. Somebody told me about a year ago that penicillin was discovered 18 times before Sir Alexander Fleming discovered it. People had no context for it. They had no paradigm for it. In fact, it was usually noted in experimental reports as a footnote explaining that some of the cultures had been destroyed by it. It was seen as a nuisance. Typically, in fact, paradigm breakthroughs come from somebody noticing what seems to be a problem is really a gift. Recently, I spoke to a conference of chief executive officers of hospitals from around the country, and there was a quotation on their brochure, which I love, and I can't remember what famous person said it, but it was some well-known person. We are presented with many opportunities brilliantly disguised as problems. If we could get the hang of that and realize that every stuck place we come to is a potential breakthrough, then maybe we would quit fighting them, and we would feel not so in pain going through it, and maybe learn to translate that into discomfort. So what we learned from Thomas Kuhn is that human history, our understanding of nature and so on, our intellectual history, you might say, is this series of radical shifts of understanding, each of which is generally rejected when it's first presented. Now, the point is sometimes made by people that it is, and I would like to acknowledge this in case anybody's thinking this, that of course many crackpot theories come up that deserve to be rejected. The important thing is to allow it in long enough to consider the possibility. Niels Bohr, the physicist, one time was asked what he thought of a theory that had been recently proposed by one of his colleagues. He said, it isn't crazy enough to be true. I mean, he knew and understood. The nature of nature is very strange. And I think that's part of this mind shift that we're going through, which, in fact, our science has brought us to. It's like logic brings you to the abyss. Many of you here have probably read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which is a truly wonderful book. Sounds like a rock group. But it's one of the most powerful books I ever read. And really, it's the story of how logic, if you pursue logic far enough, it takes you into the non-rational, not irrational, but beyond linear reason. A mathematician I was talking to the other day said there's a paradigm shift in mathematics, which is just really crazy. But I mean, it's like new mathematical systems that prove that there are no right and wrong answers. And similarly, our struggle to understand the brain or the electron or any of that, the nature of light, brings us to this place of ultimate paradox, of ultimate uncertainty. And this has been very important because part of our human, it's somewhat cultural, but I think it's also partly just human, is this need to know, this need to pin down. It's like we have two, in a way, contradictory drives in our nervous system and the potential in our brain for both. One is that we have this great gift and tendency to repress things we don't want to know or don't want to deal with, or to repress pain. And we have the chemistry for that. And in an evolutionary sense, it was very valuable, I'm sure, that if you broke your ankle and the saber-toothed tiger or whatever was, I know they weren't coexistent with humans, but whatever vicious animal was after you, it's good to be able to run and not feel the pain in your ankle. We've carried it a little far. It's like our stress alarm syndrome. It was great for when you had physical expression of that. But we don't have that. We're not in a situation where somebody is scared they're going to get fired. It's not like to be able to run through the forest. So that we get all geared up for kind of a physical response, which we don't have, and that's what makes us ill. Well, the brain has both the capacity to repress what we don't want to know and in a way that is short-term nice, long-term deadly, and we also have the ability to transform conflict and contradiction. And we have both of these things going in us all the time. And in a way, this whole history of understanding our resistance to new ideas, to saving new ideas, is that part of us that doesn't want to be bothered. It's just, don't tell me things. So. Now, there's an interesting cultural counterpart of the paradigm shift, another model which I'd like to mention because I think it's neat and it really helps understand where we are as a society. A man named Anthony Wallace, an anthropologist writing in the 1950s, first put out this idea of what he calls the shape of a cultural awakening. And it's very interesting because it's like a personal paradigm shift or a scientific paradigm shift. Every culture, every society, he said, comes to a place of stuckness. He referred to it as blocked mazeways in the culture. And he studied Native American tribes, he studied religious communities, various social groups. He said it's all the same. It's all the same shape. That what happens is people get to the place where they cannot do what they thought they were going to be able to do. They're stuck. The drought has gone on too many years, and we may have to move to a different place, you know, in a more primitive society. In our society right now, I think we have a lot of blocked mazeways. We have people trained to do work that they can't find jobs for. We have people, because of the economic dislocations and inflation, we have people who say we're planning to be able to retire. They can't retire. They can't afford it. People who wanted to buy houses can't buy houses. Women maybe who, when they were growing up, thought of themselves as becoming wives and mothers, had no career intention, and then suddenly find themselves heads of household trying to understand what to do. Those would be examples of blocked mazeways. People in business who suddenly the whole thing turns around and their business has to be done in a totally different way, or they're going broke, or, you know, I would say there's a blocked mazeway being experienced in Detroit right now. And what happens when the mazeways begin to be blocked is they start affecting first the more unstable members of society who get real freaked out. Then pretty soon everybody is getting tense and somewhat freaked out. And at a time like that, according to Wallace, there inevitably emerge in the society people who, and these are counterparts of the scientist who proposes the new paradigm. He called these the new lights. And the new lights are the people who say, wait a minute, so we're stuck in that place, but have you thought of this? We could do that. We could do, and they propose some new ideas. They propose some alternatives and new ways of thinking about it. They initially begin to attract attention, maybe from avant-garde thinkers, but they begin to attract attention. Then there is a backlash, which he called the nativist reaction. Now notice this in terms of questions you may have about, like, where we are, the place we have just moved through politically. By the way, I think we're moving through the backlash. But the nativist reaction, which is what he called this, the nativists are the people who say, in effect, if we did the rain dance the way the fathers did it, we wouldn't be having this drought. Now if we went back and we did it the old way and did it better and we did it with discipline, everything will be okay. So that's what we got to do. We got to go back. And the back can be back to anything. I mean, it can be, down with the revisionists. It can be back to the Bible, back to the basics, back to the land, back to something that worked once to see if that's going to work. The problem is that if something is not solving the problem, doing it harder isn't going to solve it. If it's the wrong answer, a more intense version of it, a more disciplined version of it, is still not going to change anything. But the nativists always get their day. A society will always give that one more shot. Because there's a kind of nostalgia in a way for the so-called good old days, or for when it seemed like things were simpler or whatever. So there is a kind of a natural thing. Now, it occurred to me a while back that, in fact, we do our own version as individuals of the nativist reaction. When we come to a stuck place in our lives and we see that there is another path that we could take, you're always going to give the old way one more shot, you know, because it's easier than striking out into this new direction. It isn't even dumb, you know, in a way. It's just that that's the way it is. Well, according to, it's that what we ought to do probably is pass through these stages a little faster than we do. or more consciously than we do. So what happens is you give the nativists their chance, their day, and they put in fundamentalist schools, or they do whatever they're going to do, or they want to increase the military budget, and it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is that it can't work, because times have changed. You're dealing with a whole new environment, so the old answer isn't appropriate. So ultimately, according to Wallace, the new lights prevail. That vision prevails. Most of the nativists end up moving into the vision of the new lights. And a few diehards go down with the ship, just like the old scientists die with the old paradigm. So those are a couple of patterns of cultural, scientific, whatever, resistance to change, and why it is that we do it. Now, I'd like to give you an example of what may be a change in that response that may be happening right now. And it's also a theory that I would like you to get, because I'm going to talk about it more, I'm sure, today, and I think it's real exciting. Some of you here may have seen, and those of you who take Brain Mind Bulletin may have seen the special issue we did on Rupert Sheldrake, the theory of Rupert Sheldrake. Sheldrake is a British plant physiologist who last summer published an essay in New Scientist magazine and a book that came out a week later, which has caused a considerable controversy, to say the least. I happen to think that it is probably as significant as Darwin's Origin of Species. New Scientist, in publishing this essay, said that this essay, will actually undermine our very understanding of the scientific method itself. Mm-hmm. And you may think we're bonkers for publishing it. And they really use that word, bonkers. And they said, but remember, this is the first time I've ever heard anyone in science say this, all new paradigms look bizarre at first. So however outrageous this may sound, consider that he is a serious scientist. He has a good reputation. This is presented as good science in the way he proposes it. Mm-hmm. Rupert Sheldrake, in fact, proposes in his hypothesis of formative causation that the universe does not so much have laws as habits. That's pretty radical, right? Yes. And what he says is that he believes that when an event happens, like the first bonding of a molecule, it sets up a morphogenetic field, almost like a resonance field, that is an invisible blueprint that causes other things to tend to happen in the same way. And that these fields, these invisible fields, or matrices, or morphogenetic fields, they transcend time and space. It's like they're coming from another dimension. That some things that have happened, like the bonding of the hydrogen molecule, have happened for so long that it's a very deeply entrenched habit. So it's highly unlikely there would be any mutation in that or any change in that. But that if you take it further, that in fact it is when something new happens, it sets up another field that allows other things then to happen in that way. Now, he cited as a couple of examples of puzzles or anomalies that might be explained by this paradigm. One was that when scientists in a laboratory are trying to synthesize a new organic compound, they have difficulty in obtaining the first crystal. It's very tricky. When they get it, though, then it gets easier, and then it gets easier, and pretty soon in laboratories all over the world, everybody's doing it with no problem. Now, this was a bit of a puzzle, and the explanation that science had come up with was pretty tortured, like the dance of those planets out there that we couldn't figure why they were behaving so oddly. And this, their way of accounting for how it might possibly happen, I mean, if you're looking for a linear explanation, this is what you can come up with. That maybe the scientists in the original laboratory got seed crystals in their beards and on their clothing. And when they visited other laboratories, the seed crystals fell out into the atmosphere, and that was how it got to be easier. Other example he cited is the an experiment that was done, or a series of experiments that were done at Harvard in the 1920s by a psychologist named McDougall. McDougall was trying to, was checking on the learning of rats, or of mice, and he built a water maze to see how long it would take them to learn this maze. And he began noticing that every generation of mice got smarter. They did this maze with fewer tries. So he was beginning to think that maybe the Neolamarckians were right. You know, these are the people who said that you can inherit learning. And they were pretty much discredited, but he was, well, how else do you account for this? Then a couple of other researchers said that they would try to replicate what he had found. And what happened is they couldn't even do the experiments because they found that all mice now knew this water maze. Some ran it right the first time. So there was no understanding. How did this get into mouse consciousness? You're born a mouse. You know cheese. You know the water maze. Now, what Sheldrake said is that, in fact, the original mice who learned it set up the field, which made it easier for every mouse to kind of fall into that morphogenetic field and do it that way. He suggests that the collective consciousness is the sum total of all our morphogenetic fields, of all our experiences and thoughts we ever had. And that's why it's available to us, because it's there. It's just there, and all we have to do is tap into it. He also, as a plant physiologist or plant researcher and basically a geneticist, he says that we don't understand the genetic material either. He said, if a primitive people came upon a television set, they look at it and they see these people right, in the front of it. At first, they might think, oh, there are people in that box. Then they would get more sophisticated, as we have gotten sophisticated. They would develop a more sophisticated hypothesis because they would start fooling around with the insides, and then they would conclude that, in fact, it was the transistors that contained the people. And they could prove it, because if you fiddle with the transistors, you ruin the people, right? You can make them disappear entirely. Okay, so what he says is probably the... And they would not understand that there was invisible information, another medium being broadcast through the transistors, that was causative, that the transistors were not causative, they were simply a mechanism. In his view, that's what the genetic material is. It's a mechanism for the fields. That, in fact, it is our ancestors' fields that cause us to develop as we do. I thought this was kind of interesting because I had always wondered, genetically speaking, how it made sense that some people, and I'm sure you've observed this, like if you know children and you know them over a period of time, they will sometimes look like their mother when they're little and look like their father as they get older. And sometimes those changes will emerge at age 40 or something. Suddenly someone will look like the other side of the family entirely. And you wonder, now, how could that be in the recipe? It's also of interest, by the way, this is just parenthetical, that there has been some real crazy stuff happening in molecular biology in the last few years. They've discovered what they call jumping genes, that the genetic material is highly unstable. It's not this nice little recipe book that we thought it was. And that there are a lot of blank spaces in the recipe that seem to be there to allow for improvisation. And one, just to give you a sense of how people respond to these anomalies, one researcher who was interviewed, one geneticist interviewed by some science magazine, said, this is horrifying. God, I have to change my paradigm. Okay, anyway, so Sheldrake has this model that says, in fact, that we, whatever we do, whatever we think, whatever happens, whatever events take place, set up these, what we called in the bulletin, M fields, that then cause other things to happen in the same way. And by the way, Joan, you would be particularly interested in this. Sheldrake has been in L.A. He's going to be up in Ojai with Krishnamurti. I don't know if you... Did you know that?
No.
And in fact, remind me, we'll give you numbers where he can be reached and so on. Because he's just wandering around. He is a delightful guy. He's very much younger than we thought he should be. He slept on the floor at our office for several days. He was going to sleep. He thought... California was so warm he could sleep on the beaches and that was no problem. And he wrote this book, by the way, A New Science of Life in a Christian ashram in India. It's dedicated to a Benedictine monk. One of the things he remarked in his lecture to our office staff, which I didn't hear but which Perry was telling me, is that probably the reason ritual is important, is that those fields are already set up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an interesting idea?
Yeah.
But it's like moving into that field. One of the things that fascinated me about Sheldrake is the response to Sheldrake's theory. The readers of New Science wrote in mainly to congratulate the magazine for their courage in publishing it. Nature magazine, there was a cute thing in one of the subsequent issues, there were a lot of letters to the editor, and there was a cartoon that showed this judge handing down a brief to an attorney, and the file says Sheldrake theory, and the verdict below it says, true but insane. Nature magazine, another big British scientific journal, was very put off by this theory, at least the editor was, or one of the editors, and wrote an editorial called A Candidate for Burning, which gives you an idea. They said, if books should be burned, this book should be burned. Then they got a tremendous angry response from their readership saying, what kind of scientific and intellectual freedom is that? And in fact, Brian Josephson, the Nobel laureate physicist, who also was a big TM person at one point, and so we know that he's already gone off the deep end. Brian Josephson wrote in and said, this is perfectly good science. There's nothing wrong with it. And it's a real exciting image. And frankly, at the moment, I don't care whether it's true or not. It feels true to me, and it's a wonderful new myth, and let's just go tell everybody that it's true. I talk in the book about the stages of personal transformation because they are really paradigm shifts. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that, including a lot of stuff that I have thought in the last several months and in the last year that isn't in the book about how we change or what our fear of change is about. Because that is the really, really big issue, and it runs up and down and throughout the whole society. We are not going to be able to make the breakthroughs we need to make to save ourselves if we don't understand about paradigm shifting and about personal change and why we're scared of it. I sometimes say that business is the most open segment of the society to transformation, and that's true. One of the reasons, I didn't know that until after the book was out, but it is really true. And one of the reasons is that businesses realize that what is the scariest thing is they don't have people who can innovate. You know, you have a few innovators and a few entrepreneurs, and they're beginning to see that there is something wrong with the thinking. It's not just, you know, erroneous guessing in terms of marketplace, but something fundamentally wrong. So they are putting a tremendous amount of energy into trying to find out how to get people to actualize their potential, to think creatively, to innovate, to get out of ruts. Similarly, and I'll get into this more later, where we are in terms of the in terms of war and peace, in terms of being able to move into high technology without being terrified of computers, because the people who, if we, who don't particularly take to high tech, don't learn how to, then the only people who are going to be in power of any kind in a few years are the people willing to do that. Someone has said we have had the haves and the have-nots, we're going to have the no's and the no-nots. So I mean, it's like there are many, many areas in which people, for instance, who are unable to cope with change, with the changing paradigm of relationships, are going to suffer a hell of a lot of pain. So there's just a vital need for us to learn how to overcome our fear of change and resistance to it. And even those of us who get into it as hardcore junkies feel a struggle every time a new one is coming on. And I think it's very important for us to kind of share strategies of getting through it. I talked about in the book how there are these three kind of major areas that have been catalysts for change for us right now. They have to do with kind of a historic convergence, a convergence of, the historic part of it is that certain political upsets like great turbulence like Watergate and the anti-Vietnam War activities, the human rights and various other rights movements of the 60s were a big historic push for vast paradigm changes. The scientific breakthroughs where we began to see that we began to, in fact, somehow tie down a few little artifacts of changes of consciousness through biofeedback research, through meditation research, and so on, so that we began to see that, in fact, the claims of some people that there were powers and there were ways of being beyond what we normally experience, something must be going on, even if all you had was some crude EEG measurement. So that there was a kind of that, there was that. There was the psychedelic revolution. These are just some of the historic things that happened. There were a lot of economic and international, like, interdependencies that began to emerge, so that we began to find out in the last couple of decades that, for example, how tied in we were to the oil-producing nations and so on. So there was, like, you could not, isolationist points of view became ever more untenable. The three kinds of areas that provoked change in people, though, are one is social action has been a catalyst for a lot of people. When they become involved in any kind of effort to change the society, even if it's a very limited sort of thing like fixing the potholes in the street or getting the school changed in the neighborhood school, getting the food changed in the neighborhood school cafeteria, or whether it's on a global level like ending hunger or working for peace or whatever. Any kind of social action tends to cause people to ask questions and to begin to realize that somebody made up their culture. That when you once start looking at that, that can be very provocative of rethinking, because most of us live in what somebody has called a received culture. Wherever we are on the planet, we've got that. People are a certain way, that this is right and that's wrong, and this is the right kind of dress and these are the right kinds of values, and that's how it is. And when we start questioning it, however tiny the question, it's like unraveling something. That whole kind of fiction that our culture is it starts to unravel. So for a lot of people, social action is what launches them into their personal transformation. For many people, it's some kind of life crisis. It's a divorce, a death in the family, a bankruptcy, a moving to a new part of the world. I mean, it can be a positive crisis. It's a big, something big, something unexpected. And again, it's that I always thought my life was going to be like this, and all of a sudden it's not. I mean, so you learn about uncertainty, but you also learn about surviving. And when people go through a crisis, they find out that what they thought was going to kill them didn't. So it makes it a little more possible then to move into other less threatening areas of change. The third area, the one I spend the most time on in the book, is what I call the psychotechnologies. And this is everything that people use to intentionally change themselves. From running to body work, to S, to transcendental meditation, to Tibetan Buddhism, to shamanic ritual, everything. And these technologies, it's interesting in a way that the whether it's the getting involved in social change, whether it's the life crisis, or whether it's the psychotechnologies, they're all basically alarm clocks. They're all something that wakes you up in one way or another. The psychotechnologies are modes of change that we choose, but I've lately been remarking, because I realized this is true, we never intended to change that much. Isn't that true? Okay, this brings me to a model I would like to introduce, because I think it's a very valuable way of thinking about personal change and transformation, even though it was originally written or proposed by a psychoanalyst and had to do with old-fashioned talking therapy. Karen Horney, H-O-R-N-E-Y, who was a kind of a disciple of Freud, a neo-Freudian, who broke with him on a lot of issues, was a really big observer of neurosis. She wrote a lot of books about neurosis, the neurotic personality in our time, which was written in the 30s. And kind of a summary book she wrote called Neurosis and Human Growth, which I really recommend to you if you haven't read it. It came out in the early 50s. I had a letter from Karen Horney's daughter after the Aquarian Conspiracy came out. And she said, "My mother was an Aquarian conspirator, and I don't know if you knew that." But Horney, and now what happens here is that I have netted out some stuff from Karen Horney, and you will hear a certain amount of slang in here, which is not Karen Horney, which is me. And I have also taken a couple of liberties here in that she was talking about therapy. But I believe you can translate this into the transformational process, even if what you have gone in for is not a therapist, but a teacher or a technique or whatever. It's still the same. Also, she was treating this as if there were normal people and neurotic people. My sense of it is that everybody is neurotic. I don't know anybody who doesn't carry around some bizarre thought process. And the question is, not are you normal or neurotic, but is do you have the neurosis or does the neurosis have you? She worked mainly with people who were had by their neuroses. And she did not have much hope for neurotics, by the way. But she did tell how you could break them out of it if you ever could. The main reason she didn't have much hope for neurotics is because they had built such a closed system that even when they came in for therapy, they really didn't want to be helped. And the reason she said, and again, I translate this into the transformational process. What she said is when the neurotic comes in for therapy, they do not come in to get rid of their neurosis. You might say their neurosis is their paradigm. They come in to get their neurosis fixed. They have come upon some anomalies in their neurosis. The paradigm's not working. But they really don't want to get rid of it. It is their worldview. So we go in for a tune-up. Now, what she says is you come in with neurotic conflict. And the conflict comes right smack dab out of your neurosis. Now, here's how we get neurotic. How we get neurotic is that when we're a little kid, we begin to notice that the way we are is not acceptable to the world. And so we try to figure out what is acceptable, or if we're real rebellious, what is so totally unacceptable that we can be in rebellion against this expectation. But whatever it is, we begin to construct another personality. And this is our neurotic self. The neurotic self becomes, in fact, quite complete, highly organized, and integrated. And it has figured out ways of being in the world that protect us, because it comes out of fear. When we're little kids, we may have a fear that people will withdraw from us, that they will consume us, that they will attack us, that they will abandon us. But whatever it is, we'll never be enough, as we are. So clearly, because we're smart, we get neurotic. Because we figure out, okay, I'll do this, I'll do that. And because we do it from a childish perspective, all of our solutions are short-term solutions. Little do we know they'll put us on the couch in 30 years. So, okay, how do I get my freedom? I can get my freedom by withdrawing. And nobody can touch me. And then I'll be free. Okay, so I will never allow anybody to touch me, and that's how I'll get my freedom. Or, how do I get approval? I'll find somebody who will love me forever, and I will cling to them, and I will love them, and I will love them to death. Or another solution is I will become powerful. I will become so powerful, I'll show them. So all this is the subliminal thing we develop, but we're within our neurotic paradigm, we are perfect. We've got to be perfect. We have set up these standards that are so incredible that we develop what Horney called the neurotic pride system. That's kind of interesting. This is part of the paradox. We're very touchy about this self-image we have created because we have to be perfect. So we have a lot of pride. But we also have a lot of self-hatred, because we know we're not living up to it. So that there is this vicious circle that's going all the time. She made the point that neurotics get steadily worse because of the nature of the vicious circle. Now, I made a model of this, which I think I have with me. Anyway, no place to show it to you, but you can, those of you who have paper, can draw it if you want to, and the others of you can imagine it. Imagine a circle. We're going to do this like it's a clock, okay? And at 10 o'clock, you make a circle, and it's poor self-esteem. I make up this thing differently every time I do it in terms of the words, because anything works. But the circle is poor self-esteem. Like, this is where we get this sense that we're not enough. Okay, then make an arrow from that down to another circle, which exists at 8 o'clock. And that circle is fear. Okay, so this is, it becomes our worldview, is from fear. And depending on what our early experience is, it can be a fear of withdrawal, that other people will leave us, mm-hmm. a fear of attack, a fear of withdrawal, attack, abandonment, many different fears. Okay.